Good afternoon. The first case on the court's en banc schedule for oral argument this afternoon is Motor Coach Industries versus Gian Cabani et al. Case number 78701. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? I believe you're muted, Mr. Henriotta.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir. Thank you. Mr. Kemp, you ready to go also?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, good. As you can see, three of our colleagues are in Las Vegas, in the Las Vegas courtroom. If you're not able to see them down there, let me know. And myself, Justice Perry-Gary, and Justice Kadish are here in Carson City. Justice Stiglitz is on the line and part of the video, but she can't be viewed because of a connection issue, but she's fully participating and no doubt will have some questions. So just wanted to let you know that she's also part of the argument. We just aren't able to connect her feed to view her in person. Mr. Henriad, you may proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Joel Henriad, along with my partner, Dan Polsenberg, on behalf of Appellant Motor Coach Industries, we'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal split the initial 10 minutes with Mr. Polsenberg. He will address the offset and cost issue. If I might give just a brief summary, here MCI is entitled to judgment as a matter of law because plaintiffs just didn't prove a failure to warrant case. They didn't prove that this product user, the driver, Mr. Hubbard, would have done something differently if only he had had different information. Based on Mr. Hubbard's testimony, in fact, and he's alive, he testified under oath, according to his perception of the events that day, the choices he made were consistent already with what warnings would have instructed him to do. Now, plaintiffs say that we haven't preserved this issue, but that just isn't so, and I'll get to this. The gravamen of our Rule 50A argument is exactly the same argument that we're making on appeal. Again, that this user would not have done anything differently, regardless of the information, additional information that might have been given to him. And we were never told what that additional information specifically would be. We also can't assume that the jury found causation based on the jury instructions because this special verdict form never asked them that question. Alternatively, if MCI does not receive judgment as a matter of law, then the case ought to be remanded for a new trial on liability with a correct verdict form and then also on damages that incorporates the newly discovered evidence after trial. Finally, if the court does not remand for a new trial and the judgment stands, it needs at least to be reduced to offset the settlement proceeds received from the co-defendants and the costs reduced as well. Let me go on to the JMAL argument that we are entitled to judgment as a matter of law. Plaintiffs never demonstrated any additional information about this motor coach likely would have led Mr. Hubbard, the product user, to do anything differently based on his perception of the events. And this is the essence of a warning claim. If the user had different information, would the user have made different choices? Here, Mr. Hubbard, unlike a lot of the cases, here the user is alive. He testified at trial. We know about his perceptions of the day, the choices that he made, and why he made them. And it really doesn't matter for this reason what any of the other eyewitnesses to the event say happened. In the opening brief, there's a lot of emphasis on different witnesses and where they saw the vehicles located at the time of the collision, as if that could rebut what Mr. Hubbard is saying. The user is the one who would act on any information. So it's his recollection, it's his perception that is dispositive of a warning case. Here, Mr. Hubbard never testified that he might have done something differently if he had known that there was some air blast problem. He was aware of air disturbance in general, but even if he had known, let's take plaintiff's evidence, we'll construe it in a light most favorable to them. Let's assume that there is some particular air blast issue. He never testified that if he had known that, he would have driven differently. As a matter of fact, he was emphatic that when he passed Mr. Chiabani, Dr. Chiabani, when he drove past Dr. Chiabani, it was about 450 feet behind where the moment of impact, where the location of the impact was. That was his perception, that he passed Dr. Chiabani, that he passed him at a proximity of between 3 to 7 feet, but he was certain that it was at least 3, and he thought it was closer to 7. And then he didn't see him again until seconds before the collision. He never became aware of him until moments before the collision when Dr. Chiabani was already heading towards the bus. And at that point, he said there was nothing that he could do. So let me be clear. This is not a situation where a driver sees a bicyclist and thinks that he can drive closer to the bicyclist than 3 feet under a misimpression that it won't be dangerous. It's also not a situation where he drove by the cyclist indifferent of his proximity because he didn't think there was a danger. And for a warning claim, that's what we'd have to be looking at. We would have to be looking at a situation where the driver decided to drive close because he was unaware of this air blast issue. And that's not the case. When this driver went past, he gave distance, and then when he saw the doctor again, it was already too late. So it would not have affected what he did. There's no evidence that he might have done something differently.
Mr. Henriot, can you hear me?
Yes.
Justice Stiglitz, but if we're truly going to take inferences in the plaintiff's favor, doesn't that disregard Hubbard's testimony that he saw Chiabani turn onto Pavilion Center before the bus did? So when the court finds that there's sufficient evidence for the jury to find that had he been adequately warned, essentially that Mr. Chiabani could have been sucked under the coach, that he may have driven differently when he turned onto Pavilion Center. He could have driven a lane over. He could have slowed down. If he had been properly warned, and you're drawing inferences in favor of the plaintiff, that he could have taken different action, especially when he testifies that he would have followed any safety or training warnings that he was given.
I don't think so, because I think that takes a leap from inferences to speculation. This is not a case like Sims or Lewis versus C. Ray Boats or Rivera versus versus the tobacco company, where the user was no longer alive at the time of trial, and so there had to be some type of speculation about how they might have comported themselves differently with different information. Here, it would be pure speculation to say what he might have done. When he was on the stand and testified that he didn't do those things, they could have asked him those questions. He did see him turn right in front of him, and then he testified to passing safely. So, no, I think that it is a major impermissible leap from inferences to speculation to draw that conclusion. Now, if I can go to the verdict form. This was not a general verdict form. This was a special verdict form. The court was wise to give a special verdict form. The issue is that when you give a special verdict form, it has to be complete. We proposed a complete verdict form that would have asked for causation on this question, and causation that includes both by asking for legal causation, it implies both the aspect that is heeding and then also whether or not the heeding would have made any difference. Plaintiffs opposed. The judge rejected it. After the judge rejected that proposed verdict form, at the request of the court, we cooperated with opposing counsel to try to come up with a form that integrated the judge's ruling. But ultimately, we gave that, or we objected to even that before it was given. With the time remaining, let me.
Sorry, Mr. Henriad. This is Justice Kadish in Carson City. Hope you can find me in the square on your screen there. But as to the point you just made, I know you proposed a different verdict form than the one that was given, but did you specifically object to this particular failure to warn question on the grounds that it did not include a question of causation?
We objected on the basis that it did, that a separate full causation question was not being asked. Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Henry, just before you go, on that issue, I saw the general colloquy between the court and yourself and Mr. Kemp about the verdict form. And at least in the discussion, it had talked about item number five having similar to the items that preceded it. It would be, is MCI liable for failure to warn, and then in parens was supposed to say, did MCI fail to provide an adequate warning that would have been acted upon? And it seems as if the first part of that number was dropped in the special verdict form. But then on page 3 of the special verdict form, it says, if you answered yes to any of the above liability questions, so putting MCI's failure to warn back in liability, my question would be if they were otherwise properly instructed on what they needed to find them liable on a failure to warn, and the jury special verdict form indeed called it a liability question. Why does this undermine confidence in the fact that the jury followed the jury instructions?
Because liability as a matter of law requires more than the question that was posed earlier in the verdict form. So the damages part does refer above with reference to liability, but the claim is defined differently than the instructions would define that when it comes to what is sufficient to find liability. If I could turn the time quickly over to Dan to address the offset. Thank you, Your Honor.
Tell you the truth, Mr. Chief Justice, I don't think that I have time to address the offset. Because Joel was going to save me 2 minutes, but the questions ate them up. So I think I will just submit the offset issue on the briefs.
Oh, I don't think that's prudent. We'll add 2 minutes for you to address that, and actually 2.5 minutes, and I'm going to add 2.5 minutes to Mr. Kemp's time.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Fully vet these issues.
I deeply appreciate that. Thank you. May it please the Court, Dan Paulsenberg. Tort law, even though tort law now is a sophisticated system of allocation of responsibility, when it started, it was pretty blunt and crude. It was an all-or-nothing affair. A plaintiff could sue for injuries, but if she were even 1% at fault, she couldn't recover. If a plaintiff sued one defendant and not others, that defendant would be responsible for it all and couldn't seek contribution from others. As this court explained in Cafe Moda, the legislature changed a lot of that in NRS 41.141 and 17.245. And what we're looking at is the sophisticated approach the court takes now. Plaintiffs are claiming that we are not entitled to an offset because we're a product manufacturer, and product manufacturers are not entitled to contribution, and so they're not entitled to an offset. Well, I think that's wrong on two counts. First of all, product manufacturers are entitled to contribution. The contribution, Uniform Contribution Among Tort Feasors Act in NRS Chapter 17 excludes intentional tort feasors and exempts those who have breached fiduciary duties. But it doesn't say that it doesn't apply to products manufactured.
Mr. Pulsenberg, I have a question. What if the jury had come back with $50 million in punitive damages as well, based on the manufacturer?
We haven't briefed that, but I don't think that contribution applies to punitive damages. And contribution under the Nevada statute, both 17.245 and 41.141, both say that we're entitled to an offset. And I don't think the offset applies to punitive damages. That's based on a defendant's own actions, not on a plaintiff's injuries. And as this court pointed out in a recent case, it all turns on whether the tortfeasors were responsible for the same injury. And here, clearly, they were. The funny thing is here, remember, one of the prior defendants was another product manufacturer. So I think offset applies here. The equitable principles apply here. It would be different if it were intentional, as this court pointed out in Evans versus Dean Witter. Although the court admitted there were a split in authorities for intentional tortfeasors, it made clear that contribution there would operate like contribution and offsets would operate like mitigation. And mitigation is something the legislature did not consider because it was an intentional tortfeasor. It seems bizarre to apply that principle to a strict products liability case where the defendant is liable without fault. So you don't apply intentional fault and fault-free in the same context. Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Wait, can I ask one more question?
Yes, of course, Justice Silver.
Sorry. Oldenburg.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I know you didn't hit this area, but when it comes to the argument on Drake versus Frazier, Frazier versus Drake, I have a question as to, in this particular case, you have the plaintiffs really detailing an emotion for fees beyond $1,500, and obviously both sides had very large expert witness fees due to the subject matter presented to the jury in this case. My understanding is that the plaintiffs had a very, very detailed reason why they wanted each one of the fees that they did. Whereas Frazier versus Drake, when I was on the Court of Appeals, it was one of those cases where, you know, Judge Smith just decided everybody was getting $5,000. We didn't know where $5,000 came from. $5,000 literally came from the air. Everybody got $5,000, whether it was $40,000 in fees or $2,000 in fees. So, of course, we said we want the district courts to tell us why you give a certain number. Here we have plaintiff's brief saying why the certain number. Why should we reverse it? Why can't we imply the findings here? The district court in this case said, I've considered Frazier versus Drake, but didn't go into detail, I guess, on the analysis. Why is that a reversal on this issue?
And I appreciate you bringing up the issue because you are proficient on this. So let me say that the idea of district court discretion still would apply. I don't think our argument is so much that they are locked at 1500, but 1500 is a public policy established by the legislature, and if you're going to exceed that, it should be a wholesale grant of costs to the plaintiff. Remember, to the prevailing party. Remember, we're talking about expert fees. So there has to be some reason that it would be not just above 1500, but as high as they are here. And also we're talking about litigation production and litigation assistance, which is not even an area that is an area of cost that the legislature has set out. So I think the district court's discretion is narrow in those areas, and there has to be more of a showing the higher you allow the amount of costs.
But the question I have is, didn't the amount that the district court ultimately gave in this case, as far as each one of those experts, didn't it correspond to what the plaintiffs were pretty much asking for in their brief? I mean, it wasn't some arbitrary number, right?
And forgive me, but that's rather my point. I don't think just a showing gets the prevailing party everything they're asking for when the legislature has set limits. There has to be not just a showing those amounts were incurred, but that there's a reason to go beyond the caps or the complete exclusion that the legislature has set out. So I think it is less of a deferential issue for the district court.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Kemp.
May it please the court. I'd like to start with the offset issue because I think our position has changed a little bit since the brief. As you know, a week ago Thursday, both sides at about the same time filed a supplement identifying the Lindbergh case. That was issued on August 20th, 2020, which is after the briefing by both sides. And we think that changes the offset analysis to a simple two-part inquiry. The first question is, were both defendants sued for the same injury? And we're going to concede that. They were obviously sued for the same injury in this case. The second question is, you have to identify the unique damages sought against the settling defendant and compare them to the damages awarded against the non-settling defendant. And the Lindbergh court highlighted two types of unique damages. One was treble damages, which applied in that case, and two was punitive damages. And the reason punitive damages are at issue is in the second amended complaint against the bus operator, and specifically that's on one, the record on appeal 27 is the fourth claim for relief, paragraph 58. In that paragraph, we seek punitive damages against the bus operator. So we have a case that's squarely within Lindbergh in that punitive damages are sought. And so the question, I think, becomes, well, what do you do? In this case, the settling defendant, the bus operator, paid $5 million. Mr. Polsenberg referred to the product defendant. The helmet manufacturer paid $100,000. I don't really want to spend time talking about that. But the issue is, how do you allocate under Lindbergh where you have a compensatory claim and a punitive claim? In this case, since it was just a negligence case, it doesn't come within the exception to the punitive cap of 3-1. So the most you could have got for punitives was 3 times the compensatory. So under those circumstances, we think that just like Lindbergh, which used a 3 multiplier because it was treble damages, in this case, 1 part compensatory, 3 parts punitives, you should use a 4 multiplier, divide the $5 million by 4, and give them a 1.25 credit. And so we've changed the position in our brief where we say they're not entitled to a credit to we, the clients have authorized us to stipulate on the record today to an offset to them to the $1.25 million. And on the offset issue, I think this court should determine the issue. First of all, it's equitable relief. It's an equitable set off. Second of all, Lindbergh, I think, was very careful to use the term exposure 4 different times. You look at the defendant's exposure, and the way to do that is to look at the complaint. And third, I think the equitable set-off should be simple. In most cases, if you have a negligence claim against 2 defendants, it's going to be a 1-on-1 set-off. In cases where there's treble damages, it'll be 3-to-1 like Lindbergh held. In cases like this, it'll be 4-to-1. It's a very simple calculation. And that's one of the beauties, I think, of Lindbergh is it's a pretty bright line test. And so for those reasons, that's our position on set-off. Turning to the issue of warning causation evidence, their position is that they preserved this issue in a 50A motion. Well, first of all, they filed a 50A motion. They filed a 24-page 50A motion that entire motion, and that's in the Record on Appeal 7984 to 8017. But anyway, they filed a 24, and that's volume 32 and 33. They filed a 24-page motion that was devoted solely to punitive damages. Not one word in there about compensatory damages. Not one word in there about warning causation. Not one word in there about insufficient evidence. No discussion whatsoever. Okay? And I think if you look at that, you'll see that they didn't preserve the issue. Now, they fall back on their oral motion, and in the reply for the first time, they cite two pages. They cite 9900 and 9901, and they argue that that's where they raised this issue of warning causation in the 50A motion. Well, if you look at 9900, 9900 is an argument that there's not any evidence of an air blast. That's all that argues. And if you look at 9901, and I'm going to quote it, it says that they are going to refer to the argument we made before about Mr. Hubbard having a law that would have told him to do exactly what the warning apparently would have told him to do, unquote. That's what the argument was made there. That refers to this argument that there was some sort of statute on the three-foot rule, which, first of all, there was no statute. The statute says basically that where there's one lane and you're going down one lane, you have to give 3 feet to a bicyclist. In this case, on Pavilion Center, there were not only two lanes, but there was a bike lane. So the three-foot law was clearly inapplicable. But more importantly, this was what they were raising in 9901. So they did not preserve this entire warning causation issue for appeal. They didn't address warning causation in general to the district court orally. They didn't talk about the Sims case. They didn't talk about Rivera. They didn't talk about Hubbard's testimony. They didn't say anything about it. Instead, they waited until after the verdict and ginned up this argument in the so-called renewed 50A motion. Well, you can't renew something that wasn't made in the first place.
Mr. Camp, this is Justice Kadish in Carson City. Then let me just go back to you with the question I had asked then of your colleague on the other side then. Did they object to the special verdict form that's the one actually used because the failure to warn question did not include causation? Was an objection made about that to the district judge?
Well, our argument is that this was not preserved for appeal either, because what they are arguing in the brief is that there should have been an additional question on the special verdict form, specifically, would this have prevented the injury in this case, unquote. That's what they say over and over again in the brief should have been on the special verdict form. They never tendered that question. Instead, they wanted to have a box that would be checked saying legal cause. We think that would be inappropriate because the legal cause definition was the substantial factor test. It wasn't the definition of warning causation in jury instruction 31. So they failed to tender it in the first place. So to get around that in the brief, and we think that's fatal under Allstate versus Miller, but to get around that, their failure to tender the essential language, they argued that the district court had a unilateral obligation to construct this language itself. In the brief, they say the district court had to get it right. Well, we think that directly conflicts with Allstate versus Miller, where this court held, quote, the district court does not have a sua sponte obligation to submit its own special verdicts or interrogatories, or to give improperly framed special verdicts or interrogatories. So here in this case, where they've conceded that jury instruction 31 accurately sets forth the law on warning causation, their entire argument is premised on the unstated assumption that the jury didn't follow that instruction. And we think that's wrong under Krause, because under Krause, this court held that you should presume that the jury follows the district court instructions. So what you have here is what we had in Yamaha. You have a jury instruction that is appropriate, and they concede it is, and then they're harping on the verdict form. Well, Yamaha tells us you have to read them both together, and we think you have to do it here. but especially where they didn't object to or they didn't pose the question they say now was essential, and they're arguing the district court judge should have done it, we think they've waived this issue. Does that answer the question?
It does. Thank you.
Okay. Getting back to warning causation, I think the key difference between us is we think historic compliance in and of itself is sufficient to prove warning causation. And we say that because Sims and Rivera both held that historic compliance alone is sufficient. Remember, in Sims, the janitor that would have been the recipient of the warning was killed in the accident. The case was dismissed on a summary judgment on the grounds there's no evidence of causation. That was reversed, and this court held trial evidence may indicate that historically Robert being the janitor, historically Robert had strictly heeded directions concerning his duties and safety responsibility, unquote. If so, that the court held that sufficient evidence for warning causation. Rivera approved that, okay? So we think that in this case, when you look at the testimony of Hubbard, it clearly meets the Sims test because he testified. We asked him the question, in terms of your personal habits, if you're trained about something relative to safety, do you heed those training warnings? His answer, absolutely. Now, remember, Sims said that you have to show that they strictly heeded directions. And here the driver says he absolutely heeded warnings. And in addition, he said that this was one of his personal habits. We submit this testimony alone is sufficient to prove warning causation under Sims. Now, if I heard Mr. Henriot right, he is suggesting that we have a different warnings causation test depending upon whether the recipient of the warnings died or didn't die. He is suggesting that if they didn't die, we have to ask them a hypothetical as to what they would or wouldn't have done if confronted with an adequate warning. But if they did die, he'll go with the historical compliance that Sims and Rivera endorses. I think that's a ridiculous suggestion. And also, I think one problem is that would elevate a hypothetical over objective evidence. And what do I mean by that? I mean that Sims' approval of evidence of historical compliance with the warning, that's an objective standard that can be tested. You can talk to friends, families, coworkers, question them about historical compliance. You can get examples of historical compliance or noncompliance if you're the defense. That's an objective standard. By way of comparison, what Mr. Henriot and MCI are proposing is a hypothetical to the actor regarding what he or she theoretically would have done if confronted with a warning that was never actually given. So we think that historic evidence of compliance with warnings, such as we had in this case, Sims and Rivera, is better evidence, more trustworthy than the standard they want to propose. And another problem with it is if you adopt that standard, that you have to have a hypothetical with regards to what they theoretically would have done, you're basically eliminating failure to warn liability in a wrongful death case where the actor that died is the recipient of the warning. And so for those reasons, we think sufficiency of evidence should be the standard. Turning to Mr. Henriot's contention, which I think Justice Stiglitz already addressed, that it was impossible to heed a warning in this case, I would just like to add that this also was not preserved. They didn't file a 50A motion on this. The district court specifically concluded that they had waived this, and we don't think the district court's abused its discretion in that regard. And as was already pointed out, there's three things that could have been done in this case. He could have kept following him down Charleston, which in fact is what he did. He could have gone into the left lane instead of taking the right lane. Or the Red Rock video shows he's driving down the center of the right lane. He could have hugged the right lane a little bit. But three different actions could have avoided the accident in this case. Mr. Henriot briefly discussed the newly discovered evidence. We think, first of all, there's an overwhelming public interest in preserving and protecting the finality of judgments. The district court, I think, got this right. It held that The standard under 59A is whether they used reasonable diligence and whether reasonable discovery could have uncovered what they're complaining about now. You know, and in this case, they argued that the probable support claim could have been as high as $15 million. It was actually only 2.7, so in effect, they won it. But the district court focused on the fact that, first of all, they didn't propound any discovery whatsoever to the employer in this case. But secondly, and I think more importantly, we gave them an employment authorization 7 months before the trial that they never sent in. And now they argue that they should get a new trial because they should be allowed to send a subpoena to the employer. So I think that in and of itself eliminates this argument. And finally, the district court, it's an abuse of discretion standard on that point. The district court did not abuse its discretion. The brief also talks about the three-foot law. I want to focus on that briefly because they conceded to the district court that there was an interpretation of the statute that means the law didn't apply in this case. And let me read the law. Quote, if there is only one lane for traffic proceeding in the same direction, pass to the left of the bicycle at a safe distance, which must be not less than 3 feet. That law clearly doesn't apply in this case because not only was there not one lane, there were two, but there was also a bike lane. So we have a law that they conceded the district court might not apply. They're wanting to introduce as evidence that the driver was contributory negligence. Well, first problem is that's extremely prejudicial because contributory negligence is not a defense in a product liability action. And that's why the very first motion to eliminate we filed was motion to eliminate number one that we won. The second problem is the probative value of that, a law that doesn't apply, is pretty minimal. And third, that was not the first argument they made on it. They told the court initially that the probative value was that the reason they didn't give a warning is because Nevada had this law. Well, that was just pretextual because the bus was made in 2007. The law was passed in 2011. So it was temporally impossible for this law to be the reason they didn't provide a warning. Then they argued they needed this because they had to rebut some warning their expert created. Again, pretextual. And on top of all that, the driver testified he didn't know about the law at his deposition. So we think when you look at all of this, particularly the law not being applicable, the district court properly balanced the probative value versus the prejudice in excluding reference to that law. And unless, I think I've covered the points I wanted to cover and the points that were raised, unless there's a question to me.
Mr. Kemp, there was an extensive exchange between Justice Silver and Mr. Polzenberg about the offset. You addressed or you started your argument with that point, but I would give you additional time if you had anything on that issue to add. If not, then I'll just see if my colleagues have any other questions.
Yeah, the only comment I would make is that Lindbergh specifically says that when addressing the exposure beyond actual damages, you have to look at, quote, treble or punitive damages, unquote, and see if the exposure is unique to the settling defendant. In this case, they won the punitive damages claim. So the exposure was unique to the settling defendant in this case. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions by my colleagues of Mr. Kemp? All right. Mr. Polzenberg, you and Mr. Henriod exhausted the time, but I'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal if there's anything in particular you want to call to our attention.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it. First, on the offset, everything that plaintiff's counsel has argued is nowhere in the briefs. The only issue argued in the briefs is whether or not there is a legal right to an offset at all. On the verdict form, yes, we included legal cause. This was after the judge, after a conference on the jury instructions where we had talked about whether or not the causation theory would be proximate cause or legal cause. This verdict form was proposed after the decision was made to go with legal cause.
Mr. Henriod?
Yes, yes, Your Honor.
I have a question, because I read that back and forth, and I read that you originally proposed a different verdict form, and I saw your reasoning, and there was some back and forth with Mr. Kemp saying, look, we object to that form because all it does is it's so convoluted and so specific, it's going to bring about inconsistent verdicts from this jury. It's just going to confuse the jury, keep it out. And it looks like that's why the district court then went with the other verdict form. Is there a specific site here that you could say that you objected to the portion of the verdict form, or that you requested to the district court that you add the language regarding causation on that failure to warn interrogatory?
Just that we wanted a separate question on causation, not that we add particular language to lengthen the question that was already being asked.
Do you see what I'm saying? You're objecting to that specific language not being on that interrogatory. And I just was wondering where in this colloquy, because I didn't see where you all objected to that particular portion on the failure to warn.
Your Honor, I think it's I believe the objection is preserved in the initial request to have the jury asked about causation in particular. And with that, my time has expired. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Henriot, Mr. Polsenberg, and Mr. Kemp. As always, excellent arguments and briefing. The matter will stand submitted, and the court will be in recess until 3 p.m. Thank you.
Thank you.